The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The 76th World Health Assembly was held in Geneva, Switzerland, the 21st through the 30th of May this year. The Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, UNAIDS for short, and the Open Society Foundation sponsored a side event at WHA 76 that was entitled Responding to the Global Crisis of Overdose. This event brought together an expert panel to review global trends on overdose and to discuss what progress has been made in the past decade on overdose intervention and response. The discussion started with remarks by Christine Stegling, the Deputy Executive Director of the Policy, Advocacy, and Knowledge Branch at UNAIDS and an Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations.
And maybe just as a starting point before I launch into my remarks, you know, for us at UNAIDS, including talking about harm reduction and including people using drugs in our prevention work is a real priority. We had a big meeting here on Wednesday night, a ministerial meeting with the Global Prevention Coalition. And the speaker, there were two speakers from civil society. One was a young woman from Ghana, a young woman living with disability, and the other was representing their input, the network of people who use drugs. So it is high on our agenda. Be assured that we take issues around harm reduction and drug use very seriously at UNAIDS. The link between efforts on HIV prevention and harm reduction for people who use drugs goes back to the very early days of the AIDS pandemic, as Sarah has also mentioned. Since the beginning of the pandemic, people who inject drugs have been among the key populations disproportionately affected by and living with HIV. And in the 1990s, the world started to scale up access to harm reduction and HIV prevention and treatment for people who use drugs. I know I'm preaching to the converted here, but we know that research since has overwhelmingly demonstrated that needle and syringe exchange programs act as a bridge to life-saving medical services like HIV testing and treatment for drug dependency. Integrating HIV and harm reduction services has been extremely effective at curbing death related to both HIV and drug use. As you know, UNAIDS is a joint program of 11 co-sponsors, and one of our co-sponsors and the one who leads much of the work on harm reduction, UNODC. For UNODC, overdose prevention and management remains a strong focus of its work, both through its drug treatment and care program and through its HIV prevention efforts. But today, we know that progress that we have made is under threat due to an alarming increase in the rates of opioid overdosing. A key factor globally is the presence of fentanyl and other strong synthetic opioids and the illicit drug supply, coupled with increased availability and decreased costs of many drugs. According, and I know, Sarah, you mentioned, we are not sure how big the problem is, but according to the UNODC World Drug Report of 2022, opioids accounted for almost 70% of all direct drug-related deaths in 2019, most of which were due to overdoses. Opioid overdosing is an important issue for the global HIV community. We must connect people who use drugs to the newest health technologies for both HIV prevention and for harm reduction. The harm reduction tools and strategies required to improve the health and lives of people who use drugs are well known, and especially well known to this crowd, and readily available. Needle and syringe programs reduce the spread of HIV and other blood-borne viruses. Opioid agonist therapy and other evidence-informed forms of drug dependence treatment curb illicit drug use, reduce vulnerability to infectious diseases, and improve the uptake of health and social services. Naloxone, including a take-home version, is an effective treatment for opioid drug overdoses and saves lives. UNAIDS co-sponsors UNODC and WHO are jointly leading the Stop Overdose Safely Initiative, and I'm sure you will speak to us about that in a minute, Dimitri. It has demonstrated the effectiveness of take-home naloxone in low- and middle-income countries. The program has reached more than 14,000 people with naloxone and training in Ukraine, in Kazakhstan, in Kyrgyzstan, and just Tajikistan. UNODC's work on opioid agonist therapy goes hand in hand with its efforts to prevent overdoses, connecting the community of people with opioid dependency to OAT in ways that are accessible and tailored to their needs, reduces the risk of an overdose and has wider health and social benefits, including the risk of acquiring HIV. So just as harm reduction programs offer portals to HIV prevention, testing, and care services for people living with or at risk for HIV should be equally attuned to the risk of overdose and the need for harm reduction. As we have learned with HIV, when we are working to prevent or address overdosing, we need to meet people where they are. This includes recognizing that abstinence may not work for everyone and that withholding assistance or punishing people and their loved ones only harms them and worsens their health. Punitive laws and policies and HIV and drug-related criminalization do not reduce incidence of HIV infection or drug use. They just drive people away from the tools of health that help keep themselves and those around them healthy and safe. And I'm sure colleagues here from programming will talk about that later. As UNAIDS and as the Joint Program, we know that we cannot stop the AIDS pandemic by criminalizing people living with HIV or by criminalizing LGBTIQ people or sex workers. We also know we cannot stop the rising incidence of overdosing by criminalizing drug use. In the HIV response, we engage with parliamentarians who make the law, judges who interpret it, and law enforcement officers who enforce it, educating them so they are supportive of a public health and human rights-based response to HIV. One of our other co-sponsors, UNDP, has done considerable work in this area, effectively helping parliamentarians and judges become part of the solution for both HIV and other health challenges. UNODC has conducted training for more than 6,000 law enforcement stakeholders in a number of countries, teaching them to consider human rights and public health in their roles as first responders. As we have experienced with AIDS, overdose mortality has long-term global economic, social, cultural, and political implications. And similar global health leadership is needed to have a successful response. Similar leadership as in the HIV response is needed to lead a successful response to overdose. Our path to ending HIV or AIDS as a public health threat by 2030 is clear. We know how to end this health crisis, and we have the tools to do so. And as so often when we talk about prevention, what we need is the political will and funding to ensure effective prevention and treatment reach everyone in need. This means overcoming barriers of stigma, of discrimination, and of criminalization. The path of how we work to end AIDS is a blueprint for what is needed to overcome the public health crisis of opioid overdoses, getting the best new health solutions to all people everywhere equitably and affordably, so that the individual health of all people who use drugs may be protected, which in turn protects public health.
That was Christine Stegling, the Deputy Executive Director of the Policy, Advocacy, and Knowledge Branch at UNAIDS and an Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. She was speaking on a panel sponsored by UNAIDS and the Open Society Foundation that was entitled Responding to the Global Crisis of Overdose, which was held as a side event on May 26th at the 76th World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Cecilia Farfan is head of research at the Center for U.S.-Mexican Studies at the University of California, San Diego, where she oversees the center's research and policy engagement activities covering security, migration, democracy, and Cali Baja.
So we have a big challenge in front of us. So for the last year available for which we have data, in the U.S. alone, we know that 107,000 people have died from preventable overdose deaths. Now, 75% of these deaths have involved at least one opioid, and 2/3 of these deaths have involved a synthetic opioid, mostly illicitly manufactured fentanyl. So the data are clear in the sense that this is creating a tremendous human cost in our communities. Now, the risk that we're facing is that because of this loss of life that we're facing, is that we're just going to renew the war on drugs. So the urgency to stop these preventable deaths is just creating this reaction to renew this war on drugs. Now, as a scholar who focuses on organized crime, I can assure you, and I cannot underscore this enough, we're not going to arrest ourselves out of this problem. This is not the way that we are going to solve what we're facing today. So what do I mean by renewing a war on drugs? So let me just give you three quick examples from the California-Mexico border. So in California, one of the things that is worrying us is that we're seeing a push for passing legislation that are these drug-induced homicide laws, which essentially means that if I'm a user and I share a substance with Mark, and Mark dies from an overdose, I could be charged for murder. Now, if the goal is to save lives, we have plenty of evidence to know that this is not the way to save lives. If anything, it alienates, as Dimitri was pointing out, people from accessing services. They will not go to harm reduction spaces for the fear of being criminalized, and it will roll back gains like the Good Samaritan laws that allow people to call for help without fearing that they're going to get in trouble because they're also using substances. Now, this is particularly worrisome considering that California has been at the forefront of leading harm reduction efforts. So the fact that we are seeing discussions around this type of legislation in a place like California should really raise some red flags. Now, what we're seeing in Mexico too, one of the things that the war on drugs does in the narrative is precisely create undeserving populations. So from the study that Dimitri just shared with us, we learned that in Central Asia, communities are learning when we have access to these spaces, we also feel that our lives matter. Now, what is happening in Mexico with the narrative of these war on drugs is that users who were in medically assisted treatments receiving methadone are no longer receiving this methadone. And in the Q&A, I can get into the reasons why this is happening. So this is leading people to look for heroin and look for fentanyl, which is only leading now to more overdose deaths at the U.S.-Mexico border region, where we see a lot of concentration of these users. So again, that narrative of the war on drugs that dehumanizes is also creating more deaths. Now, the third point that is very concerning to us and that we're seeing not only happening in California, but certainly happening in the United States, is that there's a narrative around mass poisoning. So that Mexican criminal groups are deliberately poisoning unsuspecting American users by trafficking this illicitly manufactured fentanyl. Now, this raises two areas of concern for us. The first one is it ignores the data that suggests that now there's a demand for fentanyl. So San Diego heroin users, for example, report that now it's incredibly difficult to find heroin in the city, that you can only find fentanyl. So on the one hand, it sort of erases the data that and the evidence that is out there that users now also have a preference for fentanyl. And secondly, and perhaps, you know, more importantly, it creates or it takes the question around substance use and it turns it into a security problem. So if it's Mexican organizations, criminal organizations that are poisoning unsuspecting American citizens, then it's a problem of law enforcement. It stops being a problem of public health. And that is a huge area of concern when we're talking about, you know, rolling back these gains that have been achieved in the last years in drug policy. But I don't want to end on a grim note. And even though in academia, we're very good at pointing out what doesn't work, and we are definitely less efficient at saying what does work, I do want to highlight some areas where I think we could work together, and especially in light of the evidence that has been collected in the last decades. So as the introductory remarks pointed out, there's no one-size-fits-all approach to what we're doing, but that is not intention with having a global health response to these opiate overdose deaths that we're seeing. What it means is that it creates a lot of space for working in these community-level interventions. Precisely as it was mentioned in the beginning, only communities know what is it that they need. And so this creates a good space, in my opinion, for policy to work with what has proven to be effective in these spaces. Now, this doesn't always mean that the state or the government has to do something. And this is a point that we have observed at the California-Mexico border in particular. So California civil society organizations have, I don't want to say excess, but they have extra supplies of naloxone, for example, that they want to donate to civil society organizations in the state of Baja California that provide those harm reduction services. Now, naloxone remains a controlled substance in Mexico. So the naloxone that exists in these harm reduction places is largely there through what I will call an irregular supply. Now, these harm reduction organizations in Mexico are not asking the government to purchase naloxone. What we have been working for is to just cut that red tape that allows civil society in California to make these donations in a legal way to its Mexican counterparts. So some of this work doesn't necessarily involve the state putting more resources, but rather working with already existing mechanisms that civil society at the subnational level has already devised. Now, the other point that was also mentioned in the initial remarks has to do with supporting these data collection efforts. If we don't measure things, they don't exist. And so overdose deaths, as we were pointing out initially, are likely underestimated globally, not because they're not happening, just because we're not measuring it. And so this means that, you know, I can tell you with high level of precision what is happening in the United States, but I cannot do the same for Mexico. And so that's also a space where a lot of support in collecting data, how do you collect and analyze it, can come in. And importantly, bring into it a gender perspective, because of course we know there's a need to mainstream gender into these data collection efforts. And finally, and I think this is a call for not so much civil society, but certainly international organizations, governments, and academia in improving our dissemination efforts. We don't just want to preach to the converted, as Christine was mentioning earlier. We're very good as scientists as collecting data. We're less efficient at communicating that information. So, for instance, most people in the U.S. probably don't know that if they had a medical procedure, they've probably been administered fentanyl, right? And good for them. We don't want them to have surgery without anesthesia. I don't wish that on anyone, right? But because of the narrative that now exists around this substance, the nuance gets lost. And I think we have a very important job in making sure that the data that we have is disseminated into that wider audience. And we have to think in more creative ways, you know, how to do it. I'm not suggesting that we go and, you know, record a TikTok, you know, dancing about, but we should definitely think more creatively about how is it that we communicate this information. And with that, I'll stop my remarks. Thank you.
That was Cecilia Farfan, head of research at the Center for U.S.-Mexican Studies at the University of California, San Diego, where she oversees the center's research and policy engagement activities covering security, migration, democracy, and Cali Baja. She was speaking on a panel sponsored by UNAIDS and the Open Society Foundation that was entitled Responding to the Global Crisis of Overdose, which was held as a side event on May 26th at the 76th World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Inez Mejia is an external consultant to the Ministry of Justice in Colombia.
At the last CND, Laura Gil, a former vice chancellor of Colombia, began her speech by saying, quote, Colombia is tired of laying the dead and persecuting its peasants for this failed war, end quote, in reference to the war on drugs. It is a well-known story that my country has played a central role in the policies of interdiction, crop substitution, and criminalization of illicit markets, and has played a leading role in the war that has left hundreds of thousands of victims. Another perhaps less known aspect is the progressive side of the drug use policy that Colombia has been consolidating for years. Self-cultivation of 20 cannabis plants and the supply of seeds is permitted by law since 1986. The possession and personal use of minimum doses of illicit drugs has been decriminalized on constitutional grounds since 1994, although people who use drugs still face stigma and moral judgment, of course. Cannabis for medical use was regulated in 2016, and we are on the verge of the approval of cannabis regulation for adult use by the parliament. And like most of Latin American countries, along with Mexico, Colombia has heroin use in six major cities. Harm reduction is embraced as public policy for almost two decades now, including opiate substitution treatments, and needle and paraphernalia programs currently operating in all cities where heroin use take place. The public health impact of injecting drug use, the public health impact of injected drugs is clear, with prevalence rates up to 24% for HIV and up to 80% for HCV among people who inject drugs in cities such as Cali, where injecting drug use mainly affects people in conditions of poverty and vulnerability. Following WHO recommendations, the Ministry of Health issued guidelines to access naloxone in the community in 2017. But this is only available in injectable form, and there are barriers to access because a medical prescription is required. The available naloxone has saved lives in the streets of Colombia is donated by organizations such as Open Society Foundations and distributed by civil society organizations. Harm reduction programs have been possible thanks to the cooperation of Open Society, the Global Fund, and on a smaller scale by public health funds. In addition, we have HIV combination prevention programs for people who inject drugs, drug testing services in party and festival settings, early warning systems, and we are now opening two of the first safe consumption facilities as part of the new drug policy.
Woohoo!
Yoo-hoo. We want to broaden the view of harm reduction not only as a public health care measure, but also as a matter of social justice. Considering the intersectionality of factors that deepen the risk, context, and conditions of vulnerability for key groups. In other words, this is not only a matter of health, but of living conditions. It is not by chance that deaths from fentanyl are concentrated in poor communities, ethnic groups, isolated and socially excluded people who seek relief from their pain and who die completely alone. Fentanyl is certainly an issue of concern to the country for several reasons. Between 2018 and 2022, 66 seizures were made in which fentanyl was found. The early warning system from the National Drug Observatory has issued alerts since 2019 due to seizures of fentanyl and pills and oxycodone pills in Cali and Pereira, indicative of diversion of pharmaceutical painkillers to the illegal market. In 2022, there were alerts of finding of synthetic opioids and fentanyl analogs in impregnated blotter paper and white powder. In Cartagena, seven people were victims of intoxication and arrived at an emergency room after using an unknown substance that was known later that it was fentanyl. The forensic office has recorded five fentanyl deaths since 2013, but the news of mysterious death by unknown substances occurs every week. 2 days ago, there was one of a couple of tourists in a hotel in Neiva. Samples of heroin mixed with fentanyl and fluorofentanyl has been found in Bogota's El Dorado airport from a shipment from the U.S. There are not reports of domestic production or clandestine laboratories yet. Last March, in a joint operation between Greece, Guatemala, and Colombia called San Martin, two people from the Sinaloa cartel were detained, and it was found that they were seeking to partnership with criminal organizations to boost fentanyl production in Colombia in cities such as Cali and Medellin. Medellin, Cali, and Pereira are the cities with the highest use of heroin in Colombia. This could be indicative of attempts to contaminate the supply of heroin on the streets, drive new demand for fentanyl, and increase the profits of the organizations that dominate the market. including opening up an alternative production route from Colombia to North America and Europe. Despite the capacity built, we face a real challenge if fentanyl finds a production route in Colombia. It is not only an internal threat because of what has happened with domestic cocaine and heroin use, in which production fuels an internal market, but because our capacity could easily be overwhelmed, considering the experience of countries which, with strong public health system, spending millions annually on harm reduction and struggling to contain the problem. There are all signs that we cannot ignore, and they present a complex panorama that demands timely and forceful responses. Our capabilities to respond is limited and requires further support. Harm reduction has not been able to scale up to the necessary level. Funds are insufficient, and this affects the continuity of the programs. Naloxone in non-injectable forms that could be given without prescription are high cost and unavailable. We continue to rely on cooperation to save lives, prevent HIV and viral hepatitis among people who use drugs. We are convinced that the road we have traveled is the right one. Following guidelines and recommendations of international partners and trying our own way, from which have learned several lessons we can and are willing to share. Now it is the turn of international allies to further contribute, defining clearer and more forceful agendas, both in the Global South and North, hopefully inspired by the effectiveness of the fight against HIV in recent decades, or to meet the Sustainable Development Goals. Agendas that should now focus not only on combating viral hepatitis, but also preventable deaths resulting from the contamination of illicit drug markets with synthetic substances such as fentanyl. The way out is the regulation of markets and the guarantee of a safe supply of drugs. And while we wait for that to come to our countries, we need measures such as safe consumption facilities, sufficient supply of naloxone without barriers, at a low cost, and ensuring that it gets directly into the hands of those who need it to survive. Pharmaceutical prescription programs for heroin and other substances. And these are just a few of the evidence-based responses we need to make our communities safer environments for all. In sum, Colombia is a country that has shown a counterintuitive institutional solidity, given its violence, inequality, and prominent role in drugs production. We need to work together with multilateral agencies to get the tools and resources to respond to challenges that we are now facing as a country and as a region.
That was Inés Mejía, an external consultant to the Ministry of Justice in Colombia, speaking on a panel sponsored by UNAIDS and the Open Society Foundation that was entitled Responding to the Global Crisis of Overdose, which was held as a side event on May 26th at the 76th World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition. The Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.